I couldn't believe my eyes when I saw the purse lying there, right in the middle of my cousin's front yard. It had been almost a week since the break-in, and we were all still on edge, jumping at every creak in the house. But seeing the purse, seemingly untouched except for the missing cash, brought back a flood of memories and questions. "Hey Megan, come here," I shouted, my voice trembling with a mix of relief and confusion. Megan came rushing out, her face pale with anxiety. When she saw her purse, she let out a small gasp, her hand flying to her mouth. "How did it get here?" she whispered, her eyes wide with disbelief. We both stared at it for a moment before she gingerly picked it up and looked inside. Her debit and credit cards were still there, untouched. Only the cash was missing. "This is so weird," Megan muttered, shaking her head. "Why would they return it?" I shrugged, my mind racing with possibilities. Maybe they just wanted the money and didn't care about the rest, but why bring it back? Over the next few days, we tried to piece together what had happened. Megan called the police again to update them, but they didn't have much to add. There were no new leads, no suspicious activity reported in the neighborhood. It was like the thief had vanished into thin air. As we sat on Megan's porch one evening, sipping coffee and trying to make sense of it all, a thought struck me. "What if it wasn't a thief?" I mused aloud. Megan looked at me, puzzled. "What do you mean?" "Think about it. If someone broke in just for the money, why would they risk coming back to return the purse? It doesn't make sense. What if it was someone we know?" Megan frowned, considering the idea. "But who would do that, and why?" I didn't have an answer. But the thought wouldn't leave me alone. Over the next few days, I kept my eyes and ears open, watching for anything out of the ordinary. That's when I noticed something strange. One of Megan's neighbors, Mr. Thompson, seemed unusually interested in the whole affair. He was always around asking questions, offering unsolicited advice, and generally being more involved than necessary. "Megan, have you noticed how nosy Mr. Thompson has been lately?" I asked one afternoon as we were organizing the garage. She nodded slowly. "Yeah, it's weird. He's never really talked to us much before, but now he's always around." A creeping suspicion began to form in my head. "Do you think he could have something to do with this?" Megan looked shocked. "Mr. Thompson? No way, he's just a lonely old man." "Maybe," I conceded. But I wasn't convinced. That night, I decided to do a little investigating of my own. I waited until it was dark, then slipped out of the house and made my way to Mr. Thompson's place. His lights were off, and there was no sign of movement inside. I crept around to the back, my heart pounding in my chest. There, in his trash can, I found something that made my blood run cold. Crumpled at the bottom was a piece of paper with Megan's name on it. It was a note, written in shaky handwriting, apologizing for taking the money and explaining that he was desperate and needed it to pay some overdue bills. I couldn't believe it. Mr. Thompson, the quiet, unassuming neighbor, had broken into Megan's house and stolen her money. But why return the purse? I took the note back to Megan, and we confronted Mr. Thompson the next day. He broke down in tears, confessing everything. He had lost his job and was struggling to make ends meet. He knew it was wrong, but he was desperate. After taking the money, guilt had consumed him, and he returned the purse, hoping to alleviate some of his shame. We were both shocked and saddened by his confession. In the end, we decided not to press charges. Instead, we helped Mr. Thompson get in touch with some local community services that could assist him.
I never thought that a knock on the door could change everything. But that morning, it did. For 6 months, the four of us had fallen into a routine that felt like some cruel joke. Rhett, Oliver, Steve, and I, carpenters by trade, unemployed by circumstance, had spent each day in a desperate search for work. Rhett and Oliver, seasoned craftsmen, had taught me most of what I knew. Steve, on the other hand, had always been the strong, silent type. A big guy, built solid, but with a quietness that made him seem distant, like he was lost in a place none of us could reach. We'd start each day the same. Breakfast at the diner down the street, coffee that tasted like burnt rubber, and stale conversation about our empty prospects. Then, we'd head back to my place, scouring the job ads over a couple beers, pretending we didn't know what the result would be. No work, no hope. That morning, though, was different. There was a heaviness in the air, a sort of quiet that wasn't natural. Rhett was pacing, his eyes darting to the window every few seconds. Oliver was unusually silent, tapping his fingers on the edge of the table. Steve just sat there, staring at the wall like he was trying to see through it. "I don't like this," Rhett muttered. He had this way of reading the room, sensing that things were off. I think that's why he was always the one taking charge, keeping us focused. "Yeah, something's up," Oliver agreed, though he didn't stop his tapping. I looked at Steve, hoping for some kind of reassurance, but he just kept staring at the wall. It was like he knew something we didn't. Then came a knock. Three quick taps on the door, sharp and urgent. My heart skipped a beat, and I could see the tension ripple through the group. I don't know why, but something about that knock made my skin crawl. I opened the door to find a man standing there, dressed in a suit that didn't quite fit, like it had been borrowed. He was tall, his eyes hidden behind dark sunglasses, even though it wasn't sunny out. He looked official, but in a way that didn't sit right with me, like a wolf dressed as a sheep. "Are you gentlemen looking for work?" he asked, his voice smooth, but with an edge to it. "Yeah, we are," I said, trying to keep the unease out of my voice. "I've got a job for you. It pays well, but it's not exactly conventional." Pulling out a card and handing it to me. "Meet me at this address tonight at 9 p.m. We will discuss the details." The man turned and left before I could ask anything more, leaving us standing there, staring at the card in my hand. It had no name, just an address scribbled in ink. "What do you think?" Rhett asked, his voice low. "I don't think we have a choice," I replied, feeling the weight of those 6 months of unemployment pressing down on me. We needed money, needed something to give us purpose again. We showed up at the address at night, a rundown warehouse on the outskirts of town. The man was waiting for us there, but this time he wasn't alone. Two other men stood beside him, both of them built like they could break you in half. The job was simple, at least on paper. The man needed some carpentry work done, reinforcing a room in the basement of a warehouse. He didn't say why, and we didn't ask. But as we worked, I couldn't shake the feeling that something was very wrong. "Why would anyone need a room this secure?" Oliver whispered to me as we nailed thick wooden beams into place. "Don't think about it," I whispered back. But I was thinking about it, and I knew the others were too, especially Steve. He'd been acting strange since we got here. His unusual silence replaced by a kind of brooding intensity. I caught him staring at the door to the room more than once, like he was waiting for someone to come through. We finished the job and we were about to leave when the man stopped us. "One more thing," he said, that smooth edge to his voice now sharper. "You can't tell anyone about this, ever." There was something in his tone that made my blood run cold, like it wasn't a request. It was a threat. We walked out of there with our pay, but none of us felt good about it. The silence between us was heavy, and I could see the same question in Rhett and Oliver's eyes that was in mine. What had we just been a part of? The next day, Steve was gone, disappeared without a word, without a trace. We tried calling him. We went by his place, but it's like he vanished into thin air. A few days later, we saw the news. A body had been found in the river, beaten beyond recognition. They didn't say it was Steve, but I knew. We all did. I couldn't stop thinking about that room we built, the man's cold eyes, and Steve's haunted silence. Months passed and we tried to move on, but the past has a way of catching up. One night, I got another knock on the door, but this time it was Rhett. "I found something," he said, holding out a worn notebook. It was Steve's notebook. Inside were notes scribbled about the job, the man, and something else. Something about a hidden compartment in the room. We went back to the warehouse, just Rhett and me. I wasn't sure what we were looking for, but we had to know. We found the compartment, just like Steve had written. Inside, there was cash. A lot of it. But there was also a letter. It was from Steve. He knew. He knew what the room was for, what it was hiding. And he knew that the man wasn't going to just let us walk away. But Steve had a plan. He took something valuable from the man, something that would make him think twice before coming after us. The cash was his way of making sure we would be okay, that we could get out and start over. We did. We left town that night, splitting the cash between us. It wasn't much, but it was enough. Enough to leave the darkness behind and find some light again. In the end, Steve saved us. And although guilt still lingers, I know he did what he had to for us.
I remember that day clearly, as if it had happened just yesterday. The sun was setting, casting long shadows across the Walmart parking lot. My friend Jake and I were making our way from the car, discussing which snacks we should pick up for our movie night. We were just about to step out of the parking lot and onto the sidewalk when the sound of screeching tires shattered the calm evening air. A beat-up silver sedan swerved into the loading zone in front of us, coming to a halt with a jolt. The driver, a young woman, couldn't have been older than 25. Her hair was wild, her eyes wide with a mixture of desperation and fear. I could feel Jake tense up beside me, and I instinctively took a step back.
"Do you guys have $200 I could have?"
she blurted out, her voice tinged with panic. I exchanged a bewildered glance with Jake.
No, we don't have $200 to spare," I replied, still trying to process the suddenness of the situation.
"Shit!"
she yelled, slamming her hand on the steering wheel. Without another word, she sped off, tires screeching again as she disappeared around the corner of the building. For a moment, Jake and I stood there in stunned silence. What had just happened? It wasn't every day that someone stopped you in a parking lot begging for money. It was bizarre and unsettling. We shrugged it off, eventually, attributing it to one of the countless weird encounters one might have in a Walmart parking lot, and continued our evening as planned. A few days later, the incident was still nagging at the back of my mind. I mentioned it to my neighbor, Miss Delaney, while helping her carry groceries to her door. Her eyes widened as I recounted the story.
"You haven't heard?" she said, lowering her voice. "There's been a string of strange robberies around town. People get approached for money, and if they refuse, their cars get broken into later."
I felt a chill run down my spine. Was this related? Could that young woman have been part of something bigger? I decided to look into it further. That night, Jake and I sat down with our laptops, scouring local news sites and community forums. Sure enough, there were reports of a young woman matching the description we had seen. But it wasn't just her. She was part of a duo, working with an accomplice who would target the people who refused to give them money.
"I can't believe this," Jake muttered, shaking his head. "We could have been their next targets."
The next morning, we decided to drive back to the Walmart. Something about returning to the scene felt important, like we might find answers there. As we parked, I noticed a security guard patrolling the lot. Jake and I approached him, sharing our story and suspicions. He sighed, nodding knowingly.
"You're not the first ones to tell me this. We've been on high alert. The police are involved, but these kids are slippery. They know how to disappear quickly."
Just as we were about to leave, I spotted the silver sedan, partially hidden behind a row of carts. I nudged Jake, and we cautiously approached, the security guard following behind us. The car was empty, but it looked abandoned. As we peered inside, I noticed something tucked under the passenger seat, a small black duffel bag. The security guard called the police, and they arrived within minutes. The bag was filled with stolen items, wallets, purses, even a few pieces of jewelry. It was clear that this was their stash, hidden in plain sight. As the officer secured the area, Jake and I shared a look of relief mixed with unease. We had stumbled onto something much bigger than we had anticipated. Later that evening, back at my apartment, I couldn't shake the feeling of lingering tension. The young woman's desperate face kept flashing in my mind. What had driven her to this life? Desperation? Coercion? The next day, the news reported that the police had arrested the woman and her accomplice, thanks to an anonymous tip. I felt a strange mix of emotions, relief that it was over, and a sense of sadness for those caught in such desperate circumstances. As I sat on the couch, Jake handed me a soda, and we turned on the TV. The movie was just starting, but my mind was elsewhere. That parking lot encounter had changed something in me. It made me realize how close we all are to the edge, how a single moment can shift the trajectory of our lives. Jake nudged me. "You okay?" "Yeah," I replied, managing a smile. "Just thinking. Life's crazy, isn't it?" He laughed. "You can say that again. Now pass the popcorn." I was jolted awake by the chime above the door of the store's main entrance. It took me a moment to get my bearings as I blinked sleep out of my eyes and glanced around the dark office. My thoughts were sluggish, but something immediately felt off. I had fallen asleep doing paperwork many times before, and I usually didn't wake until the morning. But it was still dark out. It was then that I remembered the chime that had woken me. A chill ran through me as I recalled locking the door hours earlier. I did lock the door, didn't I? Yes, I distinctly remember doing so because a customer wanted to get inside, but I told him he had to wait until tomorrow. It's not like getting the latest comic was a life or death situation. I listened carefully, but there was no sound coming from the racks of comics outside my office. Still, I wouldn't be getting anything done until I checked the door. The dim lamp in the office provided just enough light for me to reach the door without tripping. The chime sounded again as I pulled it open. Huh, maybe I hadn't locked it. I glanced up and down the sidewalk, but I couldn't see anything through the darkness and rolling fog. A shiver ran up my spine as I turned back to the store. "Hello? Is anybody there?" No answer. I was probably being paranoid, but I wasn't taking any chances. I reached over and pulled the light switch, wincing as I prepared for the glare of the bulbs. But nothing happened. I flipped the switch again and again, but still nothing happened. My heart rate began to speed up, even though I tried to rationalize the situation. At least the office light was still on. I took a step towards it, and that's when it flickered and died, leaving me in complete darkness. "Don't panic, Eddie. Don't panic." Part of me wanted to rush out the door and never look back, but the rational part of me thought that was ridiculous. Besides, the keys were in my office. I held my breath and listened carefully, but no sound emanated from the rows of comics. I was alone and acting like a paranoid fool. I sighed in relief. That's when I heard the creak. It sounded a few feet to my right, and although I couldn't see anything there, I could suddenly sense a presence. My muscles tensed and I stood frozen to the spot.
Hello?
There was no response, but I could feel the presence stepping nearer until the sound of its breathing filled my ears. I was just beginning to make out the shape of the being when a light shone in my eyes and left me briefly incapacitated. I shuffled backwards and knocked over a magazine stand, the loud crash echoing in the room. I blinked rapidly, trying to regain my sight, but when my vision cleared, I almost wished it hadn't. the creature in front of me was more frightening than the scariest comic book villain I had ever seen. It held a flashlight underneath its chin, creating creepy shadows on its already terrifying face. Its glowing red eyes pierced the depths of my soul, and its rubbery skin was melting down its cheeks. It opened its mouth to reveal a set of 3-inch-long teeth sharpened into points. I was so transfixed by its face that I didn't notice the hand reaching out towards me until the creature had grabbed my throat in its talons. The slender fingers wrapped around my windpipe as its nails dug into my skin. The creature cocked its head as if it was unsure what to do with me.
"Please,"
I choked out, forcing air through my crushed windpipe.
"Let me go,"
I gasped. The creature's mouth opened even wider in what seemed to be a smile. Then it turned off the flashlight, leaving us in darkness once again. It took me a moment to notice that it had removed its hand from my throat. Was it letting me go? I stumbled towards the door and yanked on the handle, but it wouldn't budge. Somehow, it had been locked again, and the keys were still in my office. I turned around and squinted into the dark interior of the store. The emergency exit was on the other side. All I had to do was make it through the racks of comics to reach the back of the store and I would be free. As I took a step forward, a faint rumble echoed around me. The creature was chuckling. My heart sunk to my toes as I realized this was its plan. It wanted to play a game. I visualized the layout of the store in my mind. If I was quick enough and smart enough, I could escape this nightmare alive. For one stupid moment, I really thought I could do it. I darted forward and immediately felt a sharp claw rip at my back. My shirt had been torn open, but the skin hadn't been touched. Yet. My breathing grew heavier as I made a beeline in the opposite direction. But again, I was met with a touch of talons. I cried out in pain as the monster slashed my arms. The cuts weren't too deep, and I knew that was because it was still playing. In a desperate attempt to buy time, I threw a coin over my shoulder and prayed that the monster would pounce after it. It was a stupid plan, but it was all I had. I took a deep breath and steadied my legs, ready to make another run for it. I pictured the door just a few feet away. Freedom was so close. It was still too dark to see much, but thankfully the emergency door had a glowing exit sign above it. Hope surged through me as I grabbed the handle and gave it a mighty push. It opened just a crack before banging into something on the other side. The monster had blocked me in. There had never been any chance of escape. The game was designed for me to lose. The glow of the exit sign provided enough light to see the creature approach, and I watched in horror as it extended its pointed claws and gashed my skin. The smile never left its face as it tore me apart with its sharp claws, blood spewing over us both. I screamed in agony and pleaded for mercy, but the monster didn't stop until nearly every inch of me had been pierced by its talons. I was beginning to float in and out of consciousness as the creature finally pulled back. I could no longer tell what was real and what was my imagination, as I watched it pull back its face to reveal an ordinary man beneath. It was the customer who asked me to stay open late. He waved a comic in front of my face with a sadistic smile.
"You should have let me in."
I heard the bell chime once more as I faded from consciousness. It started with a text message. One random evening, as I was lazily scrolling through my phone, a notification popped up. "Hey, how are you feeling today?" the message read. It was from an unknown number. Normally, I would ignore such texts, but something made me respond. "I think you have the wrong number." The reply came almost instantly. "Oh, sorry, I was trying to reach my friend. Anyway, how are you?" I should have ended it there, but I didn't. Maybe it was boredom, maybe curiosity. "I'm good, thanks. Who's this?" She introduced herself as Emily. She was friendly, open, and our conversation flowed easily. It was as if we had known each other for years. We talked about our favorite movies, music, and even shared some personal anecdotes. One thing led to another, and we ended up chatting for hours. Over the next few days, our messages became a regular part of my routine. One night, Emily mentioned she had been a patient of my dad's. My dad was a well-known pediatrician in our town, and it wasn't uncommon for his former patients to recognize me. "Your dad was always so kind to me," she texted. "I spent a lot of time in his office when I was younger." "He's a great guy," I replied, feeling a strange sense of pride. "What did you see him for, if you don't mind me asking?" There was a long pause before the reply. "I had some issues growing up, mental health stuff." I felt a pang of sympathy. "I'm sorry to hear that. I hope things are better now." "They are," she responded, but there was something about her tone that felt off. As weeks passed, our conversations took a darker turn. Emily started sharing more about her troubled past. She talked about the bad household she grew up in and the torment she endured. I felt an increasing sense of obligation to be there for her. I tried to provide comfort, but there was always a shadow of something sinister in her words. One evening, Emily sent a chilling message. "Do you believe in fate?" "I guess so. Why?" "Because I think it's fate that we meant." "I think you're the only one who can help me." The message sent a shiver down my spine. "What do you mean?" "I need you to understand what I went through. I need you to feel my pain." Her words were unsettling. "Emily, maybe you should talk to a professional about this." "No, I need you," she insisted. "Meet me at the old park tomorrow night." Against my better judgment, I agreed. Curiosity and a twisted sense of duty drove me to the park at the designated time. The place was deserted, eerily quiet under the dim streetlights. As I stood there, I felt a growing sense of unease. Suddenly, Emily emerged from the shadows. She looked different from how I had imagined. Disheveled, eyes hollow and intense. "Thank you for coming," she said, her voice almost a whisper. "Emily, what's going on?" I asked, trying to mask my fear. She stepped closer, and I noticed something glinting in her hand. "You need to understand," she said, her voice now trembling. "You need to feel what I felt." Before I could react, she lunged at me, and I felt a sharp pain in my side. I stumbled back, clutching my wound, trying to process what had just happened. "Emily, stop!" I gasped. But she was relentless. As I struggled to defend myself, a horrifying realization dawned on me. This wasn't just about her pain. She wanted to inflict it on me. She wanted me to suffer as she had suffered. The last thing I remember before losing consciousness was the look in her eyes, cold, calculating, and utterly devoid of empathy. When I woke up, I was in a hospital bed. My dad was there, his face etched with worry. "You're lucky to be alive," he said, his voice shaking. Emily was never found. The police said she disappeared without a trace, leaving only the haunting memory of that night. I often wonder if she's still out there looking for her next victim, waiting to share her pain with someone new. Now, every time I get a text from an unknown number, a cold chill runs down my spine.
My name is Eddie, and I've lived in Thailand for the last 3 years. Living abroad isn't always easy, but I've really built a life for myself here. I have a great friend group of both locals and expats, and I love my teaching job. I grew up in rural America, and I never really felt comfortable there. As a gay kid growing up in a rural town, I had to deal with some small-minded people. I was bullied a lot, and as soon as I graduated high school, I was out of there. I haven't looked back since. Last month, I was checking my Facebook for the first time in a while, and I noticed a private message from someone that I hadn't thought about in years. His name was Tommy, and he was the main reason my childhood was so awful. He made my life miserable, He'd call me names and beat me up on a near daily basis. It got so bad that I almost didn't graduate because I was missing so much school. It honestly took me years to get over the anxiety and self-hatred that Tommy caused. I hadn't thought about him in years, mostly because it was too painful. When I saw that he'd messaged me, I felt physically sick. I stared at my laptop for about an hour before I had the courage to read the message. When I opened it, though, I was shocked to see that he'd written me an apology. It was pages and pages long. He listed off a bunch of stuff he had done to me back in high school, including things that I honestly didn't even remember. He explained that he was closeted back then, that he'd been so terrible to me because he was jealous that I could live my life openly, and he asked me to forgive him. I thought for a long time about how I should respond. I considered just ignoring it because I didn't owe him anything. But eventually, I wrote a single sentence, "Thanks for letting me know." That was it. I figured that sending something so short would show him that I appreciated the message, but that I didn't ever want to hear from him again. He responded right away, thanking me for writing back, and then he started asking me about my life in Thailand. It kind of creeped me out to know that my high school bully knew where I lived now. I wrote that it was great, and that's when we started having a conversation. He started by asking me generic questions about my life, but as we kept messaging, things got more personal. He seemed to be genuinely interested in my teaching career, and he asked me all sorts of stuff about my travels. I love teaching and traveling more than anything, so I answered his questions. This went on for over an hour, and slowly I realized that maybe he'd changed. Maybe he wasn't the monster that he used to be. Then the conversation took a dark turn. We were talking about how easy it is to travel around in Thailand, and he said, "It must help that you live so close to a subway station." That's when I realized that something was wrong. How did he know that I lived near a subway station? I'd never mentioned it. I told him that I had to go, and he said that he'd talk to me later. After that, I read through our entire conversation to see if there was any mention of the subway station that I'd forgotten about. There wasn't. However, as I read through his messages, I noticed that he knew other things about me as well. He knew that I went to karaoke on Fridays, for example. He knew that I taught fifth graders. He even knew that my students had a dance performance last month. None of this was public knowledge. There was only one explanation. Tommy was stalking me. I decided to stay off Facebook for a bit. I noticed that he sent me more messages in the next few days, but I refused to open them. I hoped that he would take the hint and leave me alone, but then something really strange happened. I was walking home from the karaoke bar at about 3 in the morning when I noticed someone watching me from the distance. He was hiding behind a dumpster, so I couldn't see him too well, but I knew that it was Tommy. My heart sank. This psycho wasn't just cyber-stalking me. He'd flown halfway around the world to find me. What did he want? What sort of mind games was he trying to play? I ran down the street and into my apartment building. I didn't turn around to see if he was still there. After that, I was always on edge. Whenever I was in a public place, I always looked around to see if I could spot Tommy. Anytime I saw someone tall and blonde, my heart raced, worried that it was him. I was getting really paranoid. Then one night, I went to the ground floor of my apartment building to use the exercise room. Usually, there are other people nearby, but that night, I was all alone. I had my headphones in, listening to a podcast, but I couldn't stop my heart from racing. I wanted to go back to my room, but I refused to live in fear. I'd left America to escape guys like Tommy, and I wasn't going to let him ruin my new life here in Thailand. I used the treadmill for a bit, trying to stay calm, and then the door to the exercise room creaked open. I looked over my shoulder, and there he was. Tommy was standing there, smiling awkwardly. He apologized for scaring me. He asked if we could just sit down and talk. I ran. I didn't know what else to do. He screamed for me to stop, chasing me through the lobby. I could have tried to get in the elevator, but I didn't have enough time. It was already so close behind me, so instead I raced out the front door and into the street. When I got to the sidewalk, he caught up to me and grabbed me by the arm. "Please," he said. "I already told you I was sorry." "Why are you here?" I asked. "I live here too," he said. "I didn't know that you were here until I saw you in a crowd, and that's when I knew that it was fate. I had to make things right. I had to tell you that I love you.
I've always loved you. I pushed him off me and backed away, right into the street. Stop! He screamed. I wouldn't. I was terrified. I kept backing away from him. And that's when he dove at me. It happened so fast, I could barely register what was happening. He pushed me with all his strength, and as I fell backwards, a screaming axe slammed into him. He wasn't attacking me after all. He was saving me from getting hit by a car. I jumped up, bruised but otherwise okay. I walked over to Tommy, who was bleeding on the asphalt. He looked up at me and tried to say something, but then he passed out. Tommy's still in the hospital now. I hope he's okay. I know he's a crazy stalker, but he still saved my life. I'm not sure if I'm going to visit him there, but if I do, I'll thank him for saving me, and I'll tell him to leave me alone forever.